Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
I'm Juan Cole. I teach history at the University of Michigan, and I'm directing the program in Arab and Muslim American Studies in the American Culture Department there. I also run a blog called Informed Comment, which apparently, from a the point of view of the public, is the more important of the credentials I have mentioned.
And of course, the re interrelationship between those things can be complex, conflictual, easy, depending on the moment, I guess, amongst other factors. And Prof. Juan, I wanted to begin by asking you if you would share with us what are the things that are currently preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you?
Well, I'm consumed with this Israeli campaign in Gaza and the global and domestic issues around it, and have been writing a lot about it at the blog as well as in other venues. It's not my professional preoccupation. I'm finishing up a book on the historical context of the Quran, and I've had a long-standing project going on peace studies in Islam, which is a neglected subject, as you might imagine. So sometimes my current affairs interests and my academic writing intersect with one another quite heavily. At the moment, that's not the case. It's different worlds.
And so perhaps that enables you to have a little bit of, it's an unfortunate word to use on my part, but peace in a sense, in the motion across the three main tasks. I wondered if I could begin though with the Gaza issue, because it's as we speak on the last day of April in 2024, it's a gigantic news issue. And in part, it seems to have become correlated with all sorts of struggles for power in US academia and in the relations between universities and governments. So I wondered if maybe you might take us a little bit inside that, but also give us your take on what's going on more generally.
Yeah, well, my colleague Robert Vitalis at the University of Pennsylvania is a political scientist, and he has argued that there has been a sort of latent white nationalism that underpins some key ideas in American political science going back a century. And he notes that this has not gone unnoticed to historians of the discipline, but that they usually dismiss the racialized sort of discourse you find openly in the first half of the 20th century as an unfortunate set of prejudices. It doesn't affect the theories that the political scientists were putting forward. And he's arguing that that's dead wrong, that it continues to be an unexamined assumption behind the discipline. And I think you see it in the work of the late Samuel Huntington at Harvard, whose last book was about the danger posed to Anglo culture, you might call it, by the Latin American immigration to the United States, which shocked me as a thesis for a book in the late 20th century by a prominent American political scientist. And of course, then he put forward his notion of the clash of civilizations, imagining that the Chinese are a Confucian civilization. I asked a Chinese student of mine recently whether she'd ever been exposed in Chinese schools to Confucius, and she denied it. That there's a Hindu civilization, and that these civilizations are kind of primordial and ethnic slash religious, and that says determines something about foreign policy, which is completely ridiculous as a thesis, of course. And I don't know how it hasn't just been laughed out of the room. We know that the United States has 14 non-NATO allies. Almost all of them are Muslim majority states. And it has one NATO ally, Turkey, which is a Muslim majority state. The division between Christian civilization and Islamic civilization doesn't seem to say very much about American foreign policy at all. So I think that the Israeli project of, since 1967, colonizing the West Bank, has been attractive to elements in American society. It's been argued by Melanie McAllister that in the post-Vietnam War era, the successes of the Israelis at Entebbe and so forth functioned in the same way that the Rambo movies did. And we lost the Vietnam War, but in the Rambo movies we won. So the Israelis become a kind of symbolic Rambo for an American empire in crisis, and so I think there's you know emerged in both major political parties in the United States and among much of the establishment a sense that being pro-Israeli is being pro-American, that the Israeli project had something to do with upholding American values and the position of the United States in the world. And this sentiment was held in the absence of any actual knowledge of what the Israelis were doing in the West Bank and Gaza, and in an absence of any sense of empathy with the Palestinians, who were, of course, positioned as terrorists, what was being done to them was so horrible. But if they in any way objected to it, they were branded terrorists and put therefore off the table as somebody that you could empathize with or whose situation you might understand. I think coming into this crisis, that was the cultural and political situation. And what has happened since the outbreak of the Gaza campaign that the Israelis are pursuing against the civilian population of Gaza is a profound generational divide. In part, it's driven, I think, by different ways of consuming media. So young people watch the news on their smartphones. I was taken aback recently. A young person said, "Well, we've seen this war on our phones." And being a man of the 20th century, I thought to myself, "Well, I could have watched my phone a long time a few years ago and not found out anything at all." TikTok and other places that news clips can be shown, and not just news clips, but clips from the people in the Gaza Strip, just people who ran their smartphones and managed to upload the video. Those are ubiquitous and are being seen by young people, and they're horrible. They're a repeated horror movie. 70% of the people who have been killed in the Israeli campaign are women and children. And it should be said, a large number of the others are non-combatant men. Grandfathers, toddlers, etc., bloodied, lying on the ground, turned into mincemeat. More recently, images of starving children, because there's a huge humanitarian crisis. The major United States cable news networks and corporate news networks have not completely ignored the Gaza story, but have not covered it very much, I believe, as a matter of policy. And the older people who watch those channels haven't seen the war.
And
And
probably on some of the earlier remarks in what you said about academia, one of the elements in development studies in the United States in the post-war period, in the 50s and 60s, was an effortless white male parthenogenesis project based on an imagined United States that would be a model for the so-called developing world that would provide an alternative attraction to Maoism, Marxism, Leninism, and other isms, seems to me. And of course, Huntington was the last surviving prophet from all of that. In terms of your being surprised at what he came up with, I mean, I think he comes from the Huntington family that pioneered, in inverted commas, US railways. So, in that sense, perhaps it shouldn't be such a surprise. But of course, the Clash of Civilizations comes from originally from Bernard Lewis, right? Historian of the Ottomans, but particularly their early period, picked up by his pal Huntington. And it seems to me there's something going on in that moment right after the Cold War, where there are a couple of stories that are being told in the United States. One is the Fukuyama, end of ideology, sort of going beyond Daniel Bell to say, well, we've won. And everyone's going to become a liberal democrat capitalist. Now, of course, he's renounced that, something that no person in their right mind would have said 35 years ago, but nevertheless. And then the other is the Lewis piece, which comes out in something like January 1990, which says, look out, because this is the next coming thing. And in a sense, it's about something at the core of differences between Islam and, in inverted commas, the West. So that was just a quick response on the academic side to what you were saying, as I'm seeing it anyway. And I wondered about that in the context of these supposedly massive differences between Islam and, in inverted commas, the West. You work at the University of Michigan, quite a lot of Arab Americans in Michigan, not all of whom will be Islamic, of course, but why is there supposed to be this huge divide? And is that something that you would question?
Oh, well, certainly. The entire problematic, in my view, comes from mid-19th century Central European nationalism, which is a cauldron of falsehoods, but which have been enormously attractive and influential and have reshaped the world. The idea that there are races. The Germans in the 19th century actually would speak of being proud of being a pure race. Well, of course, we know from contemporary genetics that we probably all have a common ancestor within the last couple thousand years. There's no races, we're all mixed up. There are geographical phenotypal races in the sense of if you're living in a continent like Africa with a high UV rays, then you'd better, the nature will darken your skin to protect you over time, or it will choose out the darker offspring in each generation because they're more likely to survive. But the phenotype, the skin is a big organ. It's only 2% of our genetic endowment. So doesn't matter very much. And underneath, we're a young species. We're probably 200 or 300,000 years old. We haven't had time to differentiate from one another. So this idea of there being races, and then the Central Europeans tied race to soil, which seems particularly daft. So I remember Roman sources complaining about the Germans showing up. I mean, they haven't always been there, They were at some point seen to be interlopers, and especially across the Rhine. So it's bizarre that they should try to position themselves as primordial. And, you know, now the Hindutva movement in India is doing this, that the Aryans have always been in India, despite all of the archaeological and other evidence that we have that came into the India at some point and spread around their language, which is virtually the same as ancient Greek and ancient Latin. So the this is the, these ideas of race and soil, and how and then race is somehow connected to culture, so that Germans become intrinsically Christian, even though we know that they weren't initially, and that then there are severe differences between races and between the cultures that races bear. And this kind of thinking became very virulent, because what happens if you're not of the right race or the right culture and you're misplaced into Germany? Well, then you get anti-Semitism on a large scale and ultimately the Holocaust in order to restore the purity of the German race. The very, I mean, not only inaccurate ideas, not only daft ideas, but extremely pernicious ideas, because they appeal to the worst instincts in human beings. The Zionist movement took these ideas up, especially revisionist Zionism, which is now supreme in Israel, that there's a Jewish race and it's attached to a particular soil, despite all the evidence we have of Jews being all over the world for thousands of years and so forth. But they're only really Jews, only really fulfilled if they're on the soil to which their race is attached, and then they bear this distinctive culture and so forth. And so for a Zionist like Bernard Lewis, who was a man of the early 20th century in his formation, as a young person, served in the British intelligence in World War II, observing the Middle East as a Middle East expert. His problematic was to explain why the Middle East remained backward, why it rejected obviously superior Western values, and why it was so angry. And to explain all of those things without reference to the British and French colonization projects, and ultimately the Zionist colonization project in the region. And so his quest was to depict people of Muslim and Middle Eastern origin as poor losers. You know, in sports, you sometimes have somebody who's famously a poor loser. I don't think probably this generation remembers John McEnroe in tennis any longer, but kind of person when they lose, they instead of jumping across the court to shake a hand, they throw their racket angrily.
1972 US men's basketball team in the Olympics.
Yes.
May well have been robbed, but were not good losers, would be an even earlier example, Prof, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think Lewis's quest was to depict the Muslims as sore losers.
Yeah.
They had lost the civilizational contest with the West and with Zionism. Instead of gracefully acquiescing and doing what the Japanese or the Turks did, which was then to embrace Western values and to reconstitute themselves, they went on being angry and irrational and backward. I believe, that the basis of the Lewis thesis, which then Huntington picks up.
Picks
And
up.
it's yes.
And there is this notion of there being a huge distinction between this sort of slightly polite liberal humanist expression, the three great monotheistic religions, right? Which get clumped together even as they are differentiated very powerfully from one another, particularly Judaism and Christianity from Islam. Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Oh yeah. Well, I think in the Western telling, the Muslims are by far the most inferior of the three, the least innovative, the most distinctive, and so forth. And sure. Well, this idea of a Judeo-Christian civilization is a post-Holocaust idea, because the West finally, at long last, became ashamed of itself once it had murdered 6 million Jews for being Jews. And then, moreover, they dumped the remaining European Jews in the Middle East into this British colony, and used them as their aircraft carrier in the region. And so then there was a geopolitical alliance between the Christian civilization in Europe and North America and the Jewish civilization in the new colony of Israel. And so it became politic to speak of a unity of the two, and the
And I guess
Christian.
that gets stronger after 67, as so much of the sort of next wave of Zionism picks up on the Holocaust as its justification, which had not been a big thing in Israel for the first 20 years of its existence, I believe. Not such a huge explanation. Well,
Well, the
this.
Zionist movement, began in the 19th century. It wasn't about the Holocaust.
No, sure. But I meant in terms of the early self-mythologizing of the Israeli state was not so much about the Holocaust, but became more so, I think, after 67. This inevitably leads me to ask you about the context of the Quran, apologies for my pronunciation, which is something that you're working on now. And I wonder if we could focus on that for a moment.
Sure. Well, authors like talking about their work. I'm fortunate to be writing at a moment when there are wonderful scholars who are making magnificent discoveries, and part of what I'm about is attempting to synthesize them. I'm hoping I have my own insights as well, but I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. One of them is Ahmad El-Jalad, who's at the Ohio State University and is an archaeologist and linguist. He has been spending his summers and sabbaticals in southern Jordan and in Saudi Arabia, examining rock inscriptions. Now, it's not new news that there were rock inscriptions out there in the desert. And so facsimiles had been published in the early 20th century, occasionally by travelers or archaeologists. But they were thought to be short and to be poor in information. Because it would be so and so, may the goddess remember him kindly, pastured his sheep during the time of drought. And what would you do with that? It's kind of opaque and episodic. Wonderful for the study of early Arabic and names. But maybe of limited historical value. But Al-Jalad started finding these inscriptions that had reference to historical events. One of them says that Caesar was informed when the great caravan city of Damascus was set afire by the invaders. Likely, this is a reference to a Sasanian-Iranian invasion in the 200s or 300s, shows the loyalty of the Arabic speakers who wrote that inscription to the Roman Empire, which had taken over that part of the Middle East from 106. And then, you know, the really startling thing was that amateur archaeologists in Saudi Arabia began photographing these inscriptions that they found and putting them up on, of all things, Twitter. So you could see the photograph. And then they got good at reading the script, which wasn't always very legible. And also, there's been work on the evolution of the Arabic script, so that we can have a fair idea of which century an inscription is by how exactly it's written. And so people found inscriptions from the first century of Islam. These inscriptions are now being put into databases and analyzed intensively. Attempts are being made to connect them to historical sources. I would say it changes everything, because there had been a school of Western academics who had come to be extremely skeptical of the Muslim story about themselves. There's a problem with Islamic historiography of early Islam, which is that it's all written 150, 200, 300 years later than the fact. So it would be as though we had no sources on George Washington until the era of Woodrow Wilson. And then people went around and started collecting anecdotes from the survivors of Washington's family and around Mount Vernon. These skeptics, who were called revisionists, pointed out that, you know, oral accounts can often be anachronistic. People's stories change over time, and that if what you're really interested in is the early 7th century, then depending on a source from 770 is not very satisfactory. They pointed out that these later Muslim accounts also don't seem very much like the surviving Christian and Zoroastrian and other accounts that we have from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, which was in the early 600s of the Common Era. And so they started attempting to, I think, undermine traditional stories about the origins of the Quran on these bases. And much of the work they did was excellent and thought-provoking, and I think has lasting value. But some of their key theses, in light of what the archaeologists are now finding, are completely unacceptable. Some of them attempted to move the origins of Islam away from Mecca and Medina, from Western Arabia, up north to Palestine or Transjordan or Damascus, or even over to Iraq. And that can't be maintained, I think, any longer. So that's one exciting development.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been discovered is that if one looks at these inscriptions over time, they begin by having a lot of references to gods. And there had been a kingdom in Jordan, in what is now Jordan, in the Transjordan and northern Arabia, called the Nabataean Kingdom. It's not famous, but it actually was quite significant in its own way, and shows up in Western historiography at the margins in ways that people now forget. Mark Antony gave Nabatea to Cleopatra, for instance, and the story of John the Baptist is involved in a marriage alliance between the rulers of Palestine and the Nabataeans. So it was recognized. St. Paul is said to have gone off to Arabia before he went to Damascus, and it certainly went to Nabataea. So it's an important ancient kingdom that had its own set of gods, its own pantheon. And in Roman times, these get associated with Greek Olympian gods. So there's Alat, who's the great mother goddess, and she becomes associated with Athena. There's Mano, or Manat, who becomes associated with Fortuna or Tyche, the goddess of luck, and Aloza, who becomes associated with Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty and love. And people would write bilingual inscriptions in Arabic or Aramaic and Greek with these identifications. So, but in the sort of northern Hejaz and middle Hejaz, the people who have been looking at the history of these inscriptions find that fewer and fewer gods are mentioned over time. And ultimately, by the time you get to the 400s, it's just those three goddesses I mentioned, plus the great god, the chief god, Allah. Those are all mentioned in the Quran, by the way. But then in the 500s, we don't find any inscriptions invoking any of the gods except for Allah. And so there seems to be a shrinking of the pantheon and a tendency towards a concentration on the worship of the supreme god. It may not be at that point monotheism, but it's Max Müller, the great 19th century scholar, called it henotheism, where you worship a particular god, but maybe you don't deny that the others exist, or they might be kind of angels helping the main god or whatever, but a step towards monotheism, perhaps. And so that seems now to, as far as we can tell, to be the milieu in which Islam first arose. There was already a monotheistic reformation going on, according to these inscriptions. And there had been a monotheistic revolution, which, again, is only newly excavated by the archaeologists in what is now Yemen and the Himyarite kingdom, from about the late 300s. The inscriptions don't show gods anymore. They all concentrate on the one god, and they start using Jewish vocabulary from the Bible. God is called Merciful, Rahmanan, and the Lord, and salvation starts being spoken of. You know, pagans were not exercised about salvation, but this theme starts to show up. So it's been hypothesized that the Himyarite kings in Yemen became Jews. That became the court religion, and that a lot of Yemenis did as well. This is all still very murky and surprising. It hadn't been well known before, the work of these archaeologists. So, you know, at one point, people were saying, well, it's kind of odd that Islam developed in Western Arabia in the early 600s. Isn't that a strange place to have these, you know, theological breakthroughs happen? And so, but it turns out that the Arabians were among the more religiously imaginative people existing at that time, and not strange at all that they should produce a new religion.
That is incredibly interesting, and I can't help but think of the fact that that's news to me, whereas I woke this morning to discover new information about Plato's Last Supper,
Oh,
which
yeah.
was a front page story across the Anglo, in inverted commas, world. Whereas these fascinating findings made by your colleague and others have passed someone like me by. And that tells us something about what counts as knowledge and important knowledge of the inverted commas ancient world. But I very much appreciate your talking about how these things are so mixed and not so separate, and how much they share. Greek mythology, or whatever term one uses, the Islamic pantheon, Judaism, and so on. I think that's an incredibly useful lesson for all of us to consider. I wonder then if I might, to given you've given us this wonderful prehistory in a sense of the Quran, if we could talk about another topic that you mentioned right at the beginning, which is peace and Islam, peace studies and Islam. This is, it seems to me, a really crucial thing. You may recall the story of officers and some non-commissioned officers in the US military during the invasion of Iraq, being given copies of The Clash of Civilizations and Islam for Dummies as their two mandatory readings. And I can certainly remember hearing you talk about related issues on the radio at that time. So I've not read Islam for Dummies, I have to admit. I have read The Clash of Etceteras. Tell us about this work you're doing on peace and Islam.
Yeah. Well, peace studies began, modern academic peace studies began with the work of Johan Galtung at the University of Oslo. He's been a, has a chair, or had a chair, he's passed on, but he had a chair in peace studies. It was the first in the world. And it was a post-World War II development, I think began in the late 50s. I think for a long time it was looked upon by other academics as oddities. Historians love to write about wars, but relatively few write about peace movements. And that's changing, of course. And I think the youth movements of the 1960s produced some peace studies scholars. And, what peace is needs to be problematized. Is it the history of diplomacy around peace treaties? Is it social movements for peace, anti-war movements like those of the 1960s? But I think the answer that has been arrived at in the field is all of the above. Programs in peace studies began being established. As might be imagined, the nonconformist religious schools, those of the Quakers and the Mennonites, Haverford, for instance, took the lead on this sort of thing. And the Catholics have been quite good. There's a major center for peace studies at Notre Dame. And if you stand for the sanctity of life, then it makes sense that you would go in for peace studies. There are now hundreds of programs at universities and in North America and Europe and in the rest of the world as well. There's a major peace studies association in West Africa. And I think the field is becoming professionalized. It's becoming recognized. There are relatively still few PhD programs in it, but there are a lot of MA programs. And there's journals and refereed journals and so forth. However, the concentration of the field has been, as I said, on peace movements, on diplomatic breakthroughs, on theories of what peace might be. Galtung famously put forward a distinction between positive peace and negative peace. Negative peace is when there isn't a war. Positive peace is when you do things to ensure that wars don't happen. Maybe some social justice legislation is necessary to prevent conflict. That would be positive peace. And there's been work on the history of peace thinking and peace movements in Christianity. Also, to some extent, in Judaism and the Bible, the Hebrew Bible. Almost nothing. I don't say nothing because there are important scholars who have done things, but almost nothing on Islam in this context of peace studies. If one goes to Google Scholar and searches for Islam and peace, the hits aren't non-existent, but they're tiny compared to peace and anything else that you would like to pair it with. Buddhism, Christianity, among the great religions, obviously. And so Islam has, I think, from its inception, been put under the sign of violence by Christian writers. The first accounts of Islam we have were by Christian monks who were deeply upset, some of them, by the advent of Muslim empire in the Near East, and who saw it as bloodthirsty and so forth. They are contradicted by some other monks who found it quite tolerant and so forth. But that theme of the violence of the Muslims is there from the beginning, and of course it was exacerbated during the Crusades. Ironically enough, because as far as I can tell, the Europeans went to the Middle East, attacked people and killed, slit people's throats, both Jews and Muslims in Jerusalem, and established kingdoms. But it was the Muslims who objected to this, and Saladin, who gathered armies to kick them back out, who were the violent ones. And then, of course, in the early modern period, with the rise of the European empires, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, the British, the Dutch, the Muslims were often the ones being colonized. And when they kicked up a fuss about it, they were then depicted as barbarians and violent. And the roots of Muslim rage that Bernard Lewis went on purveying into the 1990s were all there in the colonial literature. And so when modern academia arose in the course of the 19th century, and you had the German invention of the seminar and the professorate and so forth, and knowledge was organized, Islamics were slighted. The first attempts at comparative religion concentrated on Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, and Hinduism. They didn't feel a need to include Islam. And then also in political science and sociology and so forth, you have these large generalizations. Max Weber engaged in them about the Muslim religion and culture and world. So Islam got largely excluded from peace studies as it grew up as a discipline. I had been writing a lot about the contemporary turmoil in the Middle East. Of course, all of us had our minds concentrated by 9/11 and then the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the radical movements and the wars and so forth. And by about 10 years ago, I was tired of all that. I had a colleague who told me a story. There was a Germanist, and he said he had a friend who decided to write his dissertation about some aspect of the Nazi period, and who later in life confessed that it had been an error. He said, "I hadn't realized when I started out that it meant I would have to live with effing Nazis for 10 years." So I began to feel that way about some of the extremist movements in the Middle East and the Islamophobic reaction in the West. And I decided that I knew enough about the history of the religion and the region that there was a lot of peace movement sort of activity going on that was neglected.
And this must be around the time in which you either start or conclude the work that becomes Muhammad, prophet of peace amid the clash of empires, where you're troping the clash twins.
Yes. Well, yes, that was the first of my own writing projects out of this. I also got funding from our International Institute at the University of Michigan, which kindly allowed us to hold two conferences on Islam and peace, which then became an edited book in 2021 from I.B. Torres and Bloomsbury in London, Islamic Peace Movements. Or Peace Movements in Islam is the title. So, but yes, my biography of the Prophet was the first of these. And I was trained in my youth as both a historian and an Islamicist, and I did courses on the Quran and the early Islam and so forth. And I got pulled, I think, largely by the Iranian Revolution into modern history, but I always kept an interest in the early period. So the first thing I did when I decided to look at, oh, and by the way, these themes also came up from my readers at the blog. Running that blog kind of put me in touch with the public in a way that I think some academics don't have the privilege of being. And so I would sometimes write about some peace theme in the Quran just to offset the Islamophobia that was so rampant then. I would get pushback. People would say, well, that can't be in the Quran, or they wouldn't believe it, or they wouldn't have a context for it. And so I had begun thinking about this. And so nowadays, we have databases. So I just looked in the Quran for all of the words that have connotations of peace. I discovered there are quite a lot of instances of these words in the various verses, and that you could see, if you put the Quran in chronological order, you could see a certain logic to how the themes of peace were adumbrated over time. So that became the book on the Prophet Muhammad. I went to my agent with this idea, and they liked it and pushed it. But then when it was picked up by The Nation Books, which is a consortium of the Nation Institute and the Hachette, a giant French publishing company, my editor there thought that explorations of Quran verses would be awfully tedious for the general public, and wanted me to tell some stories about it all, which indeed to hang it on the life of the Prophet, and convinced me to proceed in that way, with great trepidation, because remember, I'm writing in the wake of the era of the revisionists, who had concluded that we can't know anything solid about the life of the Prophet because all of the sources are so late. I attempted to hew closely to the Quran itself, which I had become convinced by manuscript and archaeological discoveries was early, was from the time of the Prophet. And so I was able to write a Quranic biography of the Prophet, but concentrating on these particular verses about peace. And that's done well. I mean, I think it's a mid-list book. One surprise was how well the Muslim audience liked it. It's beloved. I've gone to big conferences where I've done signings, and it was just like it sold like candy to children. It's been translated now into five or six Muslim languages. The Indonesians picked it up immediately. The Indonesians seemed to be on the ball because they were the first. The Arabs did a translation in Beirut and Algiers, which was positively reviewed. The Bosnians did one. I went to Bosnia and talked about the book last October. They invited me over. Being European Muslims, my thesis that Islam arose in this maelstrom of the conflict between the sort of late Roman Empire on its last legs and then the Sasanian Iranian Empire, and that they're kind of Roman Empire themes in the Quran. For European Muslims, this was very attractive. And for Bosnians who had been genocided and been accused of being terrorists by the Serbs and Croatians, the notion that the prophet had a peaceful dimension also, I think, was attractive to them. So one older Bosnian academic, he was a professor of history at the University in Sarajevo, said that he admired two things about the book. One was that he thought it was courageous of me to write it when I did, because it was during the ISIL episode when this so-called Islamic State was terrorizing the world. And he said, and then the other thing that he admired about it, he said, was that it was scientific in character. I think he meant that it was academic in character, that it, you know, appealed to the primary sources and so forth.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that in non-Anglo Europe and certainly in Latin America, science and formal knowledge or academic knowledge are basically synonyms in the way that they're not in the Anglo world. Speaking of trade books, Prof. Jay, you have the obligatory personal story beginning The New Arabs. And I say obligatory, but that's not to suggest that it's gratuitous or undesirable, but it's about racing around Cairo in a taxi, trying to avoid trouble. And doing so conscious that all the photos you've taken, the information you've gathered could be at risk if you guys were apprehended and loved ones are with you. And it's a very compelling story. And I wondered if you could, I mean, quite apart from what I just said, tell us a bit about The New Arabs, because this is, it seems to me, a very important thing for folks to understand, and particularly perhaps people who have very media-centric views of the so-called Arab Spring, which seem to be conditioned by the idea that people who write blogs in English and are Arabs represent something other than themselves.
Yeah. Well, the Arab Spring was a surprise and came along after my involvement in opposing the Iraq War, after I had written a great deal about Iraq, and when 9/11 and Iraq really were shaping the American view of Islam in the Middle East. And I had done a master's degree at the American University in Cairo in the 1970s. And at that time, the campus was just off of Tahrir Square, the main liberation square of downtown Cairo. And I had learned Egyptian Arabic and written an MA thesis on an Egyptian reformer had many pleasant interactions with Egyptian students hung out with them, and they were very kind to me. So when I saw students gathering in Tahrir Square, it hit me in the gut. It was visceral for me because it brought back my student days, I immediately thought, well, I have to write something about this. And it also seemed like a remarkable movement. I had advantages since I was a blogger myself. Some of the youth who were involved in those movements were active on social media, and many of them knew who I was. They were reading me. So I started going off when classes ended here at Michigan in late April. I would go off in May and the rest of the summer to Egypt and Tunisia. Ultimately, I went to Libya, where I reached out, or sometimes they knew I was in town and they reached out to me, to these youth, and I did oral history with them. And of course, bloggers are wonderful for historians, because it's like, you know, we have to go long distances to dusty archives to find the diaries of 19th century people and snoop around and what they were thinking about events. But here was a whole generation putting their diaries daily up on the web, and they were keyword searchable. You know, you could research them. So I thought this is a new kind of history that could be written.
This is like Johnny Cash announcing the joy with which he bought an electronic version of the Christian Bible.
Yes, right, exactly. as you say, the vast majority of the important writing and thinking about these things was in Arabic, to which most Western journalists who were writing about the phenomenon didn't have access. I think only 1% of Egyptians were on Twitter at that time, and Facebook was a bit more common, but also limited. A lot of communication was by smartphone texting, by SMS, so I made friends with these bloggers and got this, many of them told me intimate personal stories about their themselves, their siblings, their families, and their involvement in politics, between that and the blogging that they were doing, the internet postings, and so forth, I could put together a picture of these movements. Also, we'll have a moment of silence for the WikiLeaks individuals who have spent years in jail for what they did, but they released to me the diplomatic dispatches of the U.S. government for this period. You could just, again, they were keyword searchable. You could go and see what was the ambassador saying in reaction to certain events and so forth. So mostly, you know, diplomatic historians have to wait at least 30 years to get the documents that are declassified. It's really now become, I think, practically speaking, 40 or 50 years often. There I had them in real time. I'm sure that the State Department is peeved at me for using them, but I integrated them with the other material. I sometimes say that, you know, I think I was able to, the source material for this book was of a quality that I wouldn't have been able to get for any other period before 1950. And you go back, and ultimately you get back to where you could get these kinds of sources. But I had them in real time. And my thesis was that these were acephalous movements in the sense they had no head. They were a little bit anarchistic. And I foresaw problems about that because I met with a group of April 6th activists off of Tahrir Square. There's a famous old deli called Gopis, which was founded by an Italian. You know, Egypt in the early 20th century was very cosmopolitan and it was full of Italians and Greeks and French and British and so forth. And so I met with them at Gopis and I asked them, I said, this was in August of 2011. Now elections are coming up because the army had scheduled elections. And what are you doing about it? Are you canvassing neighborhoods? Are you trying to promote particular candidates? And they looked at me funny. Ahmed Maher, who was one of the leaders, he said, well, no, that's something a political party would do. We're planning the next demonstration. And it turns out they were kind of a one-trick pony. They could get up a pretty good demonstration, at least at that time. Over time, it becomes more and more difficult. But they weren't thinking structurally. And I didn't tell them, but I thought to myself, well, the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been running in elections for decades at that point, are going to hand your behinds to you, which is, of course, exactly what happened. So the youth, I think they set up a condition for elections But as is often the case in a transition from an authoritarian system to an electoral one, it's an electoral move and not a democratic one, because the conditions of democracy still don't exist. And anti-democratic groups can sometimes take advantage, as we saw with Milosevic in Serbia after the fall of Yugoslavia. It's the SOBs who can sometimes best position themselves to win the electoral contest once things have been opened up. So the youth opened them up, but they didn't seem to know what to do with that. In Tunisia, I had the same experience. I asked youth who had been active against Ben Ali, against the dictatorship, you know, what are you planning to do now? And they were so disgusted with the kinds of people that were running for office, some of them told me they were going to boycott the election. And again, you know, I was there to interview them. I wasn't there to give them advice. But I thought to myself, well, boycott an election is the way to ensure that the people that you don't like win it. The least successful political strategy in history is to boycott elections. Well, they were young, you know, they had grown up in very authoritarian societies where you.
And also, if you think about some of the newer social movements of that epoch in many parts of the world, elements of the anti-establishment componentry were anarchistic in the sense of disliking organizations that were not essentially face to face and that involved notions of representative politics in the conventional sense. And Prof, I wanted to ask you a couple more questions to finish from my end, if I may, and then invite you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed, which might take the form of revisiting something we've mentioned or something entirely new. Does that sound all right as a way of bringing things to a close? Great.
I'm in your hands.
So my first question is, over the 25 years that I've been reading your work, I've often wondered about the contributions as a public intellectual and the flack you do or don't receive in the United States. Although you've long been a trusted source for relatively conventional news outlets, you've often been the only voice saying what a Fred Halliday or an Edward Said might have said had they been around. What's it been like?
Well, thank you for that. I'm not sure I deserve to be in their company, but I actually don't understand that problematic. That is to say, those of us who are tenured in the United States have the luxury of being able to speak publicly on issues of burning public interest. And I can't understand why more people don't do it. Does it have sometimes pushback and unpleasant consequences? Well, sure, but in a way you're getting involved in politics. So, you know, politicians get pushed back all the time. They get criticized by their opponents and they lose elections and so forth. And in a way, you know, it's not even fair, because we professors can't lose the election. We're tenured. We're going to be a professor tomorrow and the next day and the day after that. I don't know of any tenured professor who's been fired for speaking out. The untenured, yes, they can be fired. But
Jody Dean's just been suspended from teaching.
Yes, but I predict to you that that will be the end of it. It was difficult sometimes, but and you know, at that time, I would get hate mail, but I would also get, you know, bouquets along with the brickbats, and I didn't really care about the hate mail. You know, when I was young, I went off to Beirut to study Arabic, and I did the last, well, I did two quarters of my senior year at Northwestern on a fellowship that allowed me to do research in Beirut. So that was a wonderful and unusual experience. Then I went back the following year to try to do a master's degree at AUB, at the American University in Beirut. And I was thwarted in that ambition, because when I got to Beirut, the civil war had broken out. And ultimately, I got to campus, but no classes were being held. We watched the war unfold down in Beirut from the campus of the American University in Beirut. There was a war of the hotels. Mortars were being fired. Machine gun fire peppered the night, and it was dangerous to go to certain parts of the city. And then ultimately, they gathered us together and said, "Go away. We're not going to open this year." So I ultimately went to the American University in Cairo instead. But I kept thinking the war was over, so I would go back to Beirut in summer of 77, and then in 78, 79, I worked for a newspaper there. And I was always wrong about the war having been over at that time, and it would break out again. But I think, you know, it affected me in a way that I maybe I have a little bit of PTSD. I don't enjoy war movies, by the way. Loud noises set me off. But because the Syrians used to use these recoilless rifles, which are not a rifle, but a form of artillery piece. And it was extremely loud. And they would fire it 20 times in a row, and you would jump 20 times in a row. You would never get used to it. So I suppose a little bit of a joke, but I say that, you know, as long as somebody's not shooting at me, I really don't care very much about what insults they would like to direct in my way. I think I was toughened up to the point where I have pretty thick skin in that regard. So that's, I understand, you know, if you say things that upset people or offend them, it's because they've got a different framing for the issue than you do. And I've sometimes, you know, most email hate mail is not worth replying to, but sometimes if I see a little humanity in the person, I'll engage with a discussion with them. And sometimes I've even had them come around. I've had people years later apologize to me. They've written me and said, "Well, you know, I spoke out very harshly against you in such and such year on such and such issue, but now I feel I was wrong and I want to apologize." You know, if you can't stand the heat, don't go in the kitchen. I think you don't have to be a public intellectual. If you're a professor, you can work on obscure things and write only for university outlets and never really address the burning issues of the day or get outside the ivory tower. And I don't, if that's the character of the person, that they enjoy doing that and wouldn't enjoy the other, I don't blame them. I felt a responsibility, especially after 9/11, because the entire nation was focused like a laser suddenly on my part of the world that I knew best, and aside from my own, and on my subject, which is Islam and politics. And I saw this parade of completely ignorant persons across my TV screen, journalists, commentators, retired generals, politicians, saying the most ridiculous things. And I couldn't remain silent. And so I started this blog in imitation of people like Andrew Sullivan, the journalist who had the Daily Dish blog at the time in 2001, 2002. Didn't know actually if it would ever amount to anything, because a lot of blogs didn't. But somehow it went viral. That was a surprise. It was a surprise when I started being invited on TV. But it was a challenge that I felt I should try to take up. So I feel good about it. Yes, I think it has implications for one's career. Once I started doing that, I was never going to be a dean at Harvard. You know, there's a kind of career ladder of academics where you people like to go to the Ivy League and then to rise high in the Ivy League, and you know, the salaries are good, put you in the category of the rich if you rise up to that. But it's just not something that I went from the 60s. I was kind of a hippie when I was young, and I wasn't interested in it. That would have been really horrible for me to be a dean in the Ivy League. My Lord, imagine the what you would have to do as a result, the dinners you would have to have, and with whom. And you know, the kinds of people that came out for Trump are the kinds of people that you would have to be wheedling for money and so forth. So, you know, from my point of view, there was no bad dimension of this, and I hope I performed a service. I got grants from the U.S. government to study Arabic when I was a graduate student, and I presume that Congress did that because they wanted me, people like me, to play this kind of role when the nation had a crisis.
Well, that's Title IX, I guess, of the Federal Education Act.
All
And
right, Title Six. Yeah.
Title VI, sorry. Is that Title VI? I'm sorry. Title IX is sports and gender and whatnot. Title VI, and my last question relates to Title VI of the Federal Education Act and the whole domain of area studies, because I suspected you were a beneficiary of Title VI. And I think it did and does lots of good work. I wanted to ask you about this, though, in the context of, say, Benedict Anderson's memoir, where he writes, I think, very evocatively about going to Ithaca to do his doctorate at Cornell in political science in the 60s, and how there were CIA plants, particularly with reference to Indonesia, because they're either had just been or was to be a coup that saw 500,000 people who committed the sin of being Marxists assassinated, of course, and the imposition of a dictatorship that suited Clifford Geertz and many others for decades and was seen as culturally necessarily Indonesian. And so there was another side to area studies, the sort of Huntingtonian side, but lots of other people on the liberal left more of US politics. A bunch of white guys who wanted to know about Africa and wanted to know about Asia and all the rest of it. You know this story perfectly well. So, on balance, how do we view area studies now? It's sort of a US invention. I mean, it exists elsewhere, but not really. And it was about training an elite who would push a message of liberal internationalism and US interests. And that was true for a long time, but it's become something else, something much more interesting. So I just wondered if, as my last question, you might comment on my version of area studies.
Well, you're not wrong. I mean, Title VI has its origins in the 1958 National Defense Education Act, which the title of it tells you everything. It was in direct response to the Sputnik. So it was a Cold War institution. And why did Congress suddenly want to fund Americans to study obscure languages was because you needed those languages as cudgels in the combat with international communism, as they called it. But academics being academics, didn't always sign on to that particular project. The other side of the story that you told, which is certainly true, and I think especially in the Ivy League, is that my professor, Nikki Keddie, who began her career at Berkeley in the early 1950s, wrote her dissertation on the CIA coup against Mossadegh and the oil nationalization demands that Iranians had this funny idea back then that the oil should belong to them and not to Britain. She wrote this, frankly, Marxist dissertation at Berkeley on the Mossadegh era, I don't think a member of the party, I'm not sure, but certainly Marxisant at a time when that was dangerous. Ironically enough, her father, I think, had been an industrialist in New York. So she was not a red diaper baby. She was a rebel. She got jobs here and there as a woman and a leftist in that America of the 50s and 60s and 70s. It was tough. But in the late 60s, the University of California at Los Angeles decided that it wanted to build up Middle East studies and to compete for federal grants. And the foundations, Mellon and Ford and so forth, also gave grants. They brought in from the University of Chicago an Austrian Orientalist, Gustav von Grunebaum, who had begun as a specialist in Arabic poetry in Vienna in the 30s. And in the 40s, I think with the rise of Nazism, his politics were not liked. And I don't think he was Jewish, but he was not, he was liberal and he just was not welcome. And so he fled and he ultimately got a job at the University of Chicago. And so he was brought in to create this center. He did the hiring. And he hired Nikki Keddie, much to the dismay of some of the conservatives in the history department. And one of them complained as late as the early 80s when I was a graduate student there. There were still complaints that von Grunebaum had brought in Keddie. And then he hired Lutfia Sayed Marceau, who is a prominent Egyptian historian, had been at the American University in Cairo, and who was from a major Egyptian nationalist family, and was one of the few Arab women academics who was prominent in her generation. And he brought her to UCLA. So when I went to UCLA, I was not studying with the old retired CIA guys. I was studying with I think Nikki moved to the right, and she was kind of a left liberal by the time I studied with her. But Marx was not absent from her citations, and then with an Arab nationalist woman, and these were women at a time also when people forget now, but in the late 70s and 80s, it was still rare. When I came to the University of Michigan History Department in 1984, I think there were three women out of a faculty of 56. And they'd only 10 years before had they brought in the carpenters to put a woman's bathroom in the building. So it had been a very male discipline history, and area studies also had been very male. In fact, one of the early controversies of the Middle East Studies Association in the early 70s, as I understand it, was that the men at the conference decided to have a social evening, and they brought in a belly dancer. And the few women at that time who were members staged a walkout and a protest. Area studies was an American Cold War project. There were lots of people who were in it who were establishment people, former intelligence, former defense. There were also other kinds of people in it. And I, of course, was from the 60s generation. There was a new left wing of area studies, which was influential on me. And then even some of the old CIA guys, they became area experts. They knew languages. They had been over there, and they did repentance. So Richard Cottam, who ended up teaching in political science at the University of Pittsburgh, had been involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh. And he spent the rest of his life writing books about how wrong it had been and exploring Iranian culture and doing a kind of penance. So it's the story you told is not wrong, but it's a complex story and there are other dimensions of it.
And finally, Prof. Jay, I'd like, or Prof. Hota, I'd like to invite you to add anything you may wish to what we've discussed. As I said, it might be revisiting things we touched on, or it might be something entirely new.
Yeah, well, I'm continued to be consumed by these public issues of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism, which only recently has begun to be named, I think, in this country. One of the Arab American legal defense funds has now launched an action against Columbia University for discriminating against Palestinian Americans, which is a violation, of course, of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I think that discrimination has been pervasive and widespread and institutionalized and unnamed, invisible in many ways until very recently. I'm concerned about the racialization of Muslim Americans and the demonization of even their basic vocabulary. So jihad has been picked up by the FBI as a charge that they put in indictments, whereas it's a beautiful thing in the Quran and in Muslim culture. There was a moment on Twitter when the Muslim American youths were having fun with a Newsweek article that was again in this vein of the roots of Muslim rage, picking up on Lewis's themes. And by this time, they had those people's number, and so they just made fun of it. And there was a whole round of jokes about Muslim rage, and they would put the hashtag roots of Muslim rage. One of the jokes was when your child is named Jihad and you lose him at the airport. And then Intifada now, the President Biden has denounced the term Intifada, and it's being alleged that it is anti-Semitic or racist in character. It's just the Arabic word for protest or uprising. And if you tool around the internet in Arabic looking for its use, I found an article about the 1968 student protests in Europe. It was called Intifadat 1968. It's an ordinary everyday word, but because it was used in reference to the Palestinian protests of the late 1980s and again in the early 2000s, it's been demonized by partisans of Israel as anti-Israeli or anti-Semitic. And of course, this completely phantasmagoric conflation of anti-Semitism with any criticism of Israeli government policy is truly troubling and problematic for First Amendment issues, but also very complex. I think, in a funny sort of way, we liberal arts people who attend to words and their history and who might be seen as ordinarily a little bit nerdy about it and antiquarian and so forth, that our concerns are now being blasted in the headlines of newspapers and in the communiques of the White House and so forth. And I think we really need who have this knowledge to speak out about it and to prevent Muslim Americans from continuing to be treated as second-class citizens, Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, Muslim Americans writ large, that this is, in some ways, I think, the coming great civil rights battle of the next couple decades.
Juan Cole, as I said, I've been learning from your words, both written and spoken, for a quarter of a century. It's been a great pleasure and an honor to speak with you, and I thank you very much for that.
It's been a great stop for me. Thanks for having me in.